And then there's the team aspect, which is, you know, and anybody in the military will tell you this, that you are much less worried about, again, the rational fear of a situation when you're with a team that you trust, because, and especially if you've come up in that environment where your first focus is on the person to your left and right and making sure that the conditions are safe for them, looking for things that could surprise them, then you're taking the focus off yourself and you're saying, is there anything I can be doing right now to help the rest of my team? And you know deep down, you don't sit around and talk about it all the time, but you know deep down, all of them are thinking the same thing about you. So you have 12, 15, 20 people that are hyper-focused on making sure you're safe and not worried about themselves, and the same is true in reverse. Rather than 20 people just worrying about, am I safe right now and taking care of what I need? So you really do get an exponential gain in everyone's comfort level in the moment. And I think that's applicable to any environment. Industry can run like that. Sports teams can run like that, etc.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Chris, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, it's very, very cool to have you back. You know, I got to chat with you when your first book, Team of Teams, came out. And funny enough, right after that conversation, the thing that struck me the most was when you talked about this idea of shared consciousness, and we immediately started using Slack as a team. And I said, we need a shared consciousness as a small business. And that had a profound impact on me. You know, I know that you now have a new book out, which we will definitely talk, but I want to start differently than we did last time. And I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living, and how did that end up impacting the choices that you've ended up making with your life and your career?
That's an interesting place to start. So my father was a physician. My mom was a nurse, but took years off from practicing and then went back in after I was the youngest of four. Once I was in middle school, she went back into nursing. So a medical family. Both my grandmothers were nurses. Both my grandfathers were physicians as well. My sister's a physician, her husband's physician. So a lot of medical folks in the family. But I was also raised like in just sort of, you know, perfect middle class America. You know, I was the youngest of four. We all grew up in athletics. Our parents were great, very focused on, you know, raising us as a connected family. You know, just really all American, no real issues. So I think that was the most formative part of my upbringing, was just a world of opportunity. My father had served in the military. He was in the Army Green Berets for about 4 or 5 years during the Vietnam years. Never actually went to Vietnam, trained. He was a physician at that time as well. So he was with the jungle training units down in Panama that special forces would come through before they went to Vietnam. So just the stories of that was very impactful on me. And I had an uncle that was in the SEAL teams in Vietnam. So we sort of grew up in that under the umbrella of service. My mm-hmm. grandfather had been in World War II. So that combined sort of the limitless opportunity of just really solid parents, combined with sort of a legacy of service, I think is probably what drew me into wanting to do something like that.
Now, when you started, did you know that you were going to end up being a Navy SEAL? Like, how does that process start? Like, when somebody begins in the military, is it you make the decision then, or do you start out just enlisting and you work your way up to it? Because I know SEALs are pretty much like one of the most elite groups of our military, having spent some time with them.
Yeah, the vast majority of folks, whatever you're going to do, whether it's intelligence or aviation or special operations, you apply through that channel coming in. So I knew I wanted to be a SEAL first and foremost, and SEALs happen to be in the Navy. So, and I wanted to go in as a commissioned officer. So you apply through that route, but you sort of start with the community and you work your way up into the bigger application process from there. And the SEALs very tightly manage, obviously, the flow of folks coming into their earliest selection windows, and then they own the training once you're actually signing the dotted line and in uniform.
So, you know, I've had a chance to talk with you before, as well as my friend Brian Ferguson. And if you have a question about SEAL training, I'm curious what separates the people who make it through the training from the ones who don't. How much of it is mental and how much of it is physical? And what can we take away from that? And how can people cultivate the kind of capacity that people who make it through SEAL training have in their own lives? Which I realize are three questions in one.
Yeah. Well, I'll just sort of tackle that from a few different angles. The one thing I was in uniform on active duty for a little over 15 years, and I never went back, just never had the opportunity to go back and spend time in the training pipeline as, you know, an officer that sort of oversees it. I've had, you know, obviously a lot of great friends that have done that. That's the one thing in my career that I wish I had done, because I think this question is fascinating, right? If I could answer what you just asked, you know, I'd be a billionaire, right? that is the ultimate question that anybody's trying to answer in any sort of competitive space, right? Yeah. What makes a great, what gives them the ability to make it through SEAL training, where the attrition rate's, you know, 80-85%, depending on sort of year by year. What makes a person become a great physician? Well, if you knew that, you could go to the freshman class around the country and say, okay, here are the future of physicians. Part of it is just you have to have the selection to weed that out. So even after years of experience inside the community, you could go back and find a class starting the basic SEAL training on day one of, say, 125 students. And you could go through your best gut, you know, experience based on just your intuitive sense over the years, pick the 25 guys that you think are going to make it, and you might be 30% right, 40% right. It's just so hard to tell. I mean, one guy that has just finished, you know, his third Ironman triathlon, all-American swimmer, will not make it through Hell Week. And the 19-year-old kid from Iowa who quit smoking the day the training starts will end up finishing the top 10 in the class. So there's something deep inside a person that comes out in that sort of training. And it's a combination of, I think, you know, the obvious one out of the gates is just a high level of grit, perseverance, and combined with a sort of a relentless discipline in your own sort of personal approach. And then there's deep-seated, like, no one's going to make me quit, you know, and that's where the interesting part comes out, because that's tied to your sort of deep foundational stuff that all makes us each tick, that goes back to, you know, your early days or whatever. You know, I was the youngest of three brothers. We all grew up wrestling. You know, I just got my butt handed to me by my older siblings for years. So that certainly put in me like a certain, you know, small man's attitude of, hey, I'm going to make it through this no matter what. Everybody's got some portion of that inside them as well. So, and that's critical in SEAL training for sure, because it's just the initial phase, 6 to 8 months or so, it's a pounding. You know, up every day at 4:30 and you go till 10 at night and just nonstop for months and months on end. Any one day, you know, a fit person could execute the stuff that you have to do during that window, but then you get up the next day and do it, and the next day and do it, and you extend that out for 6 months. And most guys, in my experience, would quit on Wednesday at 4:30 when the alarm went off, and they'd say, you know what, I'm done. But they could make it through that day if they had that third leg of the stool that said, hey, I'm gonna get up, put one foot in front of the other, and make it through today. So there's that, somewhere in there is that also that ability to sort of see life in small chunks and compartmentalize the pain of the long term and just say, well, I'm going to get through this next thing. And that's something that I consistently saw both in training and the community that made guys very successful, to say, look, this is going to be a really hard deployment, but we're going to do this next mission really well. Mm-hmm.
How much of an impact do the peers have on people's decisions to stick through it or to quit? And you know, what impact does, you know, the community have on the entire process of training? And in general, what is the impact of community? Because like I said, I think the thing that struck me most when I got to spend time at the Station Foundation was the sense of community that these guys had built.
Yeah, I didn't know this coming in, but I think one of the unique not better, not worse, but a unique aspect of the SEAL teams is that it's in the name. It's the SEAL teams. Like, you are expected to be a member of a team, not a uniquely capable superhero individual. And so that gets instilled at you day one at the basic training, what we call BUDS out in Coronado. And I think part of it's a legacy of the types of missions. So the SEALs obviously do a lot of stuff underwater. You never do anything underwater by yourself, right? Because it's just too dangerous. You can be dead in 10 seconds if something goes wrong. So when you're underwater, you're literally always tethered to at least one more person. So you're connected back and forth. You know exactly where your partner is at any given time. And that gives... you know, you become more than a sum of your parts. And so the early training, before you get into any sort of advanced stuff in the water or anything, is just very focused on finding individuals that understand that if you can form, you know, team trust-based bonds with others, you'll be capable of doing much more than you could on your own. So everything you do at BUDS is in groups, what's called boat crews. So there's six, seven individuals that are in charge of a boat. They do everything together. They eat their meals together. They get in line when you're doing workouts on the beach. There's six or seven folks in that line. There's a boat crew leader. Everyone plays a little role. So you're 3 months into your military career, and you don't know anything about sort of structuring big military organizations, but these are your six or seven people, and you make sure everybody's ready to go in the morning. When somebody's not there at 4:30, you run to their room and wake them up. Before you get an inspection, those six guys are checking each other out, making sure that their equipment is taken care of properly before the instructors show up. So some people are hardwired to operate well in that sort of team environment. It's just sort of in your DNA. And some people are not. Some people are just individually focused, which is also has some strengths to it, but that highlights itself very quickly in that team-based training. And then the SEAL teams then expand that up, and that mentality just grows and deepens over the years. So your initial few months in training, when you're operating as this effective team that's just sort of making it through every day, you know, 15, 20 years down the road, those have become, you know, some of the deepest tribal bonds that I've ever experienced in my life, you know, as those units are then going to war together and fighting together and losing friends together and taking care of families where the guys are in trouble or have been lost. And, you know, that just grows and grows and grows over the years, which is where I think the experiences you've had with guys that are transitioning, you're seeing the backside of that, just the intensity of those bonds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I'm also curious about is, how does your perception of fear change as you've gone through training, as you've been deployed? Like, because I mean, everything you're describing to me, especially being on the front line, sounds absolutely terrifying. I'm like, wow. I'm like, that's like volunteering yourself for death. So I'm very curious, like, how does your internal narrative around fear begin to evolve as you go through this experience?
Well, I think there's maybe two ways to look at that. One, you can, just through exposure, you know, you've surfed some big waves in your life. Sure. You know, if you went back 7 years ago and looked at the biggest wave you surfed last year, it would be terrifying, right? Yeah. There's no way you'd think that's ever possible. So you can just, your skill goes up, but your ability to mitigate the fear and compartmentalize all that also goes down. Some of that is completely logical because you're just ready to handle it. Some of it's illogical. Like a big wave could kill you now, just like it could have when you started surfing.
Sure.
But you're comfortable enough in the moment to be able to put that fear aside, and you felt this, I'm sure, in that environment. You operate exponentially better as a result of compartmentalizing what is a very logical fear, right? So if you're scared to death jumping out of an aircraft at 20,000 feet in the middle of the night, your chances of doing something stupid are exponentially higher, right? But if you can compartmentalize that, even though it's a rational fear, you're in a much safer position. So I think that's a key component of it, is just the learning to compartmentalize it over time. And then there's the team aspect, which is, you know, and I anybody in the military will tell you this, that you are much less worried about, again, the rational fear of a situation when you're with a team that you trust. Because, and especially if you've come up in that environment where your first focus is on the person to your left and right and making sure that the conditions are safe for them, looking for things that could that could surprise them, then you're taking the focus off yourself and you're saying, is there anything I can be doing right now to help the rest of my team? And you know deep down, you don't sit around and talk about it all the time, but you know deep down, all of them are thinking the same thing about you. So you have 12, 15, 20 people that are hyper-focused on making sure you're safe and not worried about themselves. And the same is true in reverse. Rather than 20 people just worrying about, am I safe right now and taking care of what I need? So you really do get an exponential gain in everyone's comfort level in the moment. And I think that's applicable to any environment. Industry can run like that. Sports teams can run like that, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I definitely want to talk about how that applies in other environments. You know, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about policy in general and, you know, sort of media narratives that get created around the military. Because I think, you know, and I'm curious to hear it from the perspective of somebody who's in the military. When you see somebody like Michael Moore go out and make the kinds of critiques that he does, or you look at somebody like Oliver Stone, who did this entire documentary series called The Untold History of the United States, in which he does a lot of criticizing, and largely it's based on criticism of United States military action. What I'm curious about is, what misperceptions do you think the public has of our military policies and you know, kind of our foreign policy based on what we do as a military?
Yeah, well, I'd say, look, I think social critics are important. So all those guys, Michael Moore, Oliver Stone, you know, the list could go on and on.
Yeah.
I think they're an important part of our society. I respect them for what they do. I respect a free and independent media, which is in a really interesting space right
yeah,
now.
And I definitely want to talk about that too.
Yeah. I mean, they're having their second coming right now, which is great to see. So those are folks like that are, you know, boundary spanners, and they really push us to think about ourselves critically. The one thing that far too many of the, maybe the documentarian side of the house, that tend to miss, and this is a generalization, some sure. get it right, but especially when it comes to the military, and this frustrated me to great end when I was in uniform, and I guess I have enough time and distance now, I'm a little more relaxed about it, but I still think it's a big miss on their side, which is if you're going to take the time to try to explain the general population around, hey, here's the real inside scoop of what's going on overseas, then also take the time to educate around how the government works. Some people nail this. Some people get this right. And I see this a lot in the media these days. I think, you know, I could name some folks in the media that I think are really doing a great job of it. But most just want to get to the conspiracy theory of, you know, the shadow world, the military that makes things happen. The next layer of that argument is, look, the military would be the first to tell you that it exists and works for civilian leadership that's elected by the population. The military will do what it is told to do, and they think that's absolutely critical to come from civilian leadership. You know, the first senior leader that I worked for that when I was, you know, moved up enough to start to have these sorts of conversations through Samuel Huntington's book on my desk, The Soldier in the State, which goes into this argument that says, ultimately, a military has to work for civilian leadership, and the onus is on those in uniform to constantly remind civilians of that responsibility that they are handing and expecting from civilian leaders. So the actions overseas are absolutely critical, and they warrant deep discussion. But if you stop the argument at, and then the military did this, well, you're missing the next very important question, which is why? Mm-hmm. Why are we doing that? Who's directing it? The military is executing policy that's being decided upon us as a collective nation by who we put into office and the decisions that we hold them accountable for. Yeah. So that it always stops, most of the time, it stops one step shy of the really important question that's much harder to answer.
Yeah, I figured I was kind of, you know, thinking about that. I remember Jurgen telling me that as well. As I asked him, he said, you know, you have to realize a lot of these orders come directly from, you know, people who are in high positions in political office. I'm curious, do you ever, as somebody who's a senior leader in the military, do you ever disagree with what you've been told by, you know, people in senior political positions and question the decisions that are being made? And are you forced to act in situations where you don't necessarily agree with the policy?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll qualify my own career. So I got out after just over 15 years. So I was mid-management, you know, so I ran units of a couple hundred. in the military, a senior leader, you'd say, you know, is 20 years and up, where they're running, you know, several thousands of folks. And then it goes up into the very strategic level in the general officer and admiral level. But the answer is yes, of course. And that's if you don't have that, you have really high risk, situation built into your nation, right? If the military is just a bunch of automatons that execute with complete belief in whatever they're told to do, then that's a little bit crazy, right? So, but I think that's where actually the beauty and the power of our military, the United States military, comes from, which is we have a volunteer force that's very, very professional in its approach, you know, capabilities that far exceed any other nation in the world when put together as a whole, of free-thinking individuals who have volunteered to put themselves in these positions. So of course they're going to disagree with, you know, I was too young, I guess, when Iraq started, but once I got in there and started to tease it out, I didn't think it was a great idea to be there. I can say that now that I'm out of uniform, but it didn't mean I was going to say no to a deployment, because that was my responsibility and the role I had chosen to play. Now, when I was there, or any other members there, are you going to execute against, you know, illegal orders? No. I mean, that's your responsibility to draw that line in the moment, and you're held accountable to that. But I think the beauty of our military is that people deploy and do their job, and they do it well, even in situations where they are close enough on the ground to think, I don't know that this is working, but I understand what our role and mission is now, so I'm going to execute it, but I'm also going to advise those above me on what I'm actually seeing on the ground. So you have to have that tension built in there. Mm.
So, you know, we touched briefly on sort of the current state of media, and I'm curious from your perspective, having, you know, been where you're at and having had the seat that you do to sort of policy and military action, what is your perspective on the current situation in media and how it's being, you know, potentially policed?
Well, it's funny. I live in D.C., so I've got great friends in the media. It's and it's an institution that I think is absolutely critical. I was a dual major in college, and my second major was journalism, and I just think it obviously has played such a critical role in our history. And I have this image in my head of the last, you know, two years or so, 3 years, when they've really gotten beaten up in a way that they haven't, or attacked really as an institution in a way they haven't in many years, of, you know, the old guy that nobody's been listening to for years, or the Post or something, walking out with his notebook and a pencil saying, hey, anybody ready to get back to real journalism? Let me show you how this is done. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, understandably, I think the digitization and mass access and all the things that other industries are dealing with have impacted the media over the last several years. And it has become around just fast distribution of sound bites, and, you know, long form thoughtful journalism there's been a gap there. I mean, there's been some outlets that have remained focused on it, but it certainly hasn't been the norm for the last 5-6 years or so. And now I think they're back in an environment where people are saying, whoa, this is really complex, and we have to get our act together and thoughtfully connect the dots here in a way that we haven't seen for a few generations. And so I think there's a rebirth of the media that's going to help us all. No matter what side you're on, that's not a political statement.
Yeah.
But a very focused media who holds itself accountable to accuracy, and who isn't afraid to invest in long form journalism and research, which isn't, I'm not talking about a long article, I'm talking about months or years of development to really understand what's happening in the world and informing people clearly about that. That makes us a much better nation as a result. So I'm excited to see what's going on, but I also think they're back in the trenches now, and they're under attack. Some of which they brought on themselves, and some of which I think is the result of sort of the information age transition.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and let's actually start talking about the book. You know, last time, you know, we talked about Team of Teams. So what really prompted the sort of, you know, decision to write this book? And then I'd like to actually go into the framework of all the ideas in the book.
Yeah, just in brief, there was always an idea to write a few major aspects of the change that we experienced overseas and what I was able to witness at a few different levels inside special operations. One of which was, okay, let's frame the big theory of the case, which we did in Team and Teams. Then let's lay out the actual framework of what leaders should be looking for if they want to go through a similar transition. And then let's talk about what leaders need to do, how they need to operate in that sort of environment, right? So, you know, there's a bit of a trilogy there. And One Mission, which was just released, is the second. And the third book, actually, Stan McChrystal is now working on the third book, which will be out in a year or so, which frames the leadership aspect of it. So this is that middle piece with a goal for leaders at every level in an organization, if they read Team of Teams or they're just experiencing this shift that we're all going through, One Mission gives them a template to map their thinking against. I mean, these, as you well know, these are not linear changes, right? So you can't just roadmap from A to Z, but we try to lay out here five or six major areas that you should be thinking about as you go through this.
How can companies and organizations do unmistakable work? Well, there are a few ways, but it involves going outside the regular standard operating procedures, and that scares companies. In a culture of uniformity, it's intimidating to choose to stand out, but I really do believe that creativity is one of the most underutilized assets in most companies, and this puzzles me because creativity applied in business directly translates into innovation. Speaking is one of the few avenues where I get to share these ideas in person rather than online. Think my message might be a good fit for your event or organization? Get in touch at unmistakablecreative.com/speaking. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/speaking.
All right, so let's get into those five or six areas, because I got a chance to read the book, and there's so much value in it. So can you kind of walk us through each of those five or six areas and give us kind of a high-level overview of each one?
Sure. I'll try to be give you the sound bites. I mean, we essentially start with this idea of the creation of an aligning narrative, right? So this was based on my reflections on what I'd experienced in my military career, and which took a while to unpack because I'm a process-oriented person. And so I initially focused on, you know, what were the changes that were made in how we executed process to get from intelligence to execution of missions. And then when I step back over now, I've been out for 5 years, it dawned on me more and more over time that really what McChrystal and our senior leadership did was they created a narrative that all of us wanted to be part of. And this goes into sort of our deep consciousness, I think, as a species, really, where we want to have purpose. We want to feel like we're part of something that matters and that our lives are living into and toward something that we believe in, right? And so there was a time where that could just be done in a slower pace, right? The speed of today's environment demands that senior leaders, and this is what really happened for us under Stan McChrystal and others, was they created a very accurate story that we were invited to be part of. And the story was around culture change and the changes in the world, and that this is a new type of battlefield. And that story is one that a lot of different industries are experiencing right now. So they created what we call in One Mission, this aligning narrative around becoming a different type of culture so that we could succeed as a collective. And what that ultimately led to was the breakdown of the tribal barriers that existed inside of the organization. So the difference between the way that I and the SEAL teams saw the world versus the way that an Army Special Operations individual might do that versus, you know, an Afghan partner versus a State Department professional. All of those are very, very different optics on what right looks like. And I think in a complex environment, you have to accept the fact that two people can be looking at the same problem at the same time from different angles, have opinions or suggestions that are run contrary to one another, and both be right in the moment, right? So that's a big tribal hurdle to overcome, right? So McChrystal, they frame this big story around culture change that showed us a pathway to what winning would look like. And so we were able to overcome our tribal differences. That is, I think, a critical starting point for any organization. Then you can get into sort of the practical aspects. Once you have that on paper, then you can look at what we call operating rhythm. How fast do you have to realign the organization against that aligning narrative? For us, that was a daily cadence that went, you know, 7 days a week, years on end, where thousands of people around the globe would resynchronize for the first 90 minutes of any 24-hour cycle. That became our operating rhythm internal. And that was based on how fast the terrorist networks we were facing were changing, not on how fast we decided we should be moving. I'm using the very royal we. I was on the receiving end of all that at that point in my career. That's an important step for any organizations to take, is to say, okay, look at your traditional structure and it's built to move on this sort of quarterly cadence probably. Now look at the external environment. How fast are problems actually changing that can rise to the strategic threat level? Do you have the ability to move that quick as well? So that's that. Somewhere in there is the operating rhythm that organizations need to adapt. And that it tends to be much faster with it, what they're doing right now. Then you can get into ideas around decentralization and communication structures that can support the speed of realigning that's necessary. And so in decentralization, what we call decision space in One Mission and in the work we do now, is this idea of using that narrative and cascading it down into the ranks and saying, okay, if you want the people that are closest to these fast-changing problems to be able to move with autonomy, that's sort of the coin of the realm in today's world, but not go so far out of bounds that they're threatening the strategy of the enterprise, then what decisions that do they need to own down at their level that they can make with independence? And that tends to be much more aggressive. We said it in brief in Team of Teams, we said, you know, decentralize until it hurts and then go a little bit further. And we go into that in much more specificity in One Mission to actually give some thoughts to senior leaders in enterprise on how they can approach that level of decentralization and give different players at different levels, different authorities, et cetera. And then underpinning all of that is the leadership change that needs to take place. And as I said, Stan McChrystal is going to go into this in much greater depth in his next book, but the argument I try to present in One Mission towards the end is, if anything, right now, all of us collectively, we have to, and this obviously applies to what we're seeing in politics as well, we have to debunk ourselves of this sort of heroic leader myth. You know, one individual is not capable of solving for these complex issues in today's world. It's really never been the truth, but we like to remember it as, oh, we won World War II because Eisenhower was such a great planner and logistician, or we united the tribes because Churchill was so influential. There's certainly aspects to that are very important and true, but there's such a deeper story around, you know, bringing together different parts of a system to make that possible. In today's world, if we try to invest all into this one heroic leader idea, we are absolutely setting ourselves up for failure. And you can see it on the backside, like what just happened at Uber is a great example, where all of the blame and the possible solutions being put at, you know, the CEO ran into problems, he's left, we're going to bring in a new person. Like, well, that's not going to solve the issue. You have to look at this as an interconnected leadership culture. And how are you as a team going to start to solve for these sorts of issues? So we overset our expectations for individuals when we do that. And then we sit on our hands and wait for the next great person to come along and solve the problems.
Hmm. Wow. So lots of questions come from this. The idea of an aligning narrative, like, how do we find that in our own lives? Like, is that something that exists on the individual level as well? Like, I kind of get it for a team, but like people listening, how can they take that and apply it to their own lives? Like, does it exist in their own working lives, in their own individual careers?
Yeah, it's actually a funny question, because I kid around with my wife that we need to write one for this idea for families. Like, and I really do think it is, because we're all, what you're trying to solve for there is think of the enterprise solution there, where you say, look, I need a truly meaningful narrative that I communicate to my organization that sort of hits them in the stomach. I always tell senior leaders, like, if this isn't painful to you and people in the organization and it forces a hard choice, then it's really not getting to what you want. What McChrystal was doing to us was forcing us to say, to look internally and say, do I want to stay in my little very, very comfortable tribal norms with my part of the special operations community, in my team room where everybody gets along, we all speak the same language and we look the same and we talk the same? Or do I want to be part of this bigger story, which means it's going to be uncomfortable at my small level because I'm going to have to look up and out and accept differences. But that's our pathway to winning, right? So that creates discomfort inside the organization, but it also can push you toward winning. And so I think at the individual level, it's easy to get caught up in sort of the day-to-day churn, right? And say, well, I want to buy this house. I want this next promotion. I want to make this much money this year, which is all maybe interesting, maybe not. If you're defining success around the next immediate thing that you're working toward, that could be a motivator to get out of bed and run every day and, you know, compete with the people on your left and right. But if you don't have a broader narrative about where that's taking you, then to what end? Because if you're a bright, talented, focused person, assume you're going to get the promotion and buy the house and make the money. Well, what are you going to do with it? So if you don't have that broader narrative, how much is enough? How big does your house need to be? So, and that's where I think when people say all the time, like, well, I know plenty of people that are really wealthy and not happy versus others that are have just enough and are extremely content and fulfilled people. I think the content and fulfilled people, they have that narrative. They knew what they wanted out of life because they knew what they were going to do with it versus I'm going to go out and get it all and then I'll figure out what to do with it. That never works out, at least not in my experience. I've never seen someone just go and amass all the stuff and then say, ah, now I've got it. Here's what I'm going to do with it. You have to start with the narrative where you're trying to get to.
How do people determine what an ideal operating rhythm is for them?
That's a great question. On an individual level, in industry, I mean, it's easier to answer in your role in an organization because you can just map it towards the work being done at the bigger level, right? You figure where you plug into that. At an individual level, here's how I would suggest that I try to look at that. And I'll steal this from my wife, Holly, who's a very thoughtful person on these sorts of things. And I've learned a lot from her over the last, you know, we've been married over a decade. And she does a great job of keeping what she calls the cocktail in balance, which I think is somewhere in there sort of gets to your point, which is what she means by that is her cocktail is a mix of physical activity. She works out. She does a lot of yoga, quiet time. She's an introverted person, so she knows she needs X amount of, you know, time per day that's just sort of introspective and literally quiet, like a quiet house, no music in the background, those sorts of things. Time to connect with the children. We have two kids, both collectively as a family and then one-on-one. Time with us as a couple. Hours of sleep per day. You know, so she knows what her cocktail looks like. She's like, if I put it all in the shaker and I mix it up, I'm good. Like, that keeps me right on balance. And if things start to get out of order, she'll start to feel it and it'll manifest. So I've learned a lot from her and I've tried to really focus on my own sort of cocktail along those lines. And inside of that is my operating rhythm. Like, my cocktail involves some sort of physical activity every day, ideally in the morning, reading every day, X amount of time focused on the work we do at McChrystal Group and connecting with team, reading, writing, etc. I know how much sleep I can get before I start to fall off and become less productive. So my personal operating rhythm is based on, I think, a fundamental understanding of who I am and how I operate. And I think a lot of that stuff's out of your control, which I think it's always interesting to learn from others. But I think the idea of saying, I think Srini's awesome, like, and I want to pick your brain, like, man, how do you do it? Tell me exactly how you live, and then I want to map to that.
Sure.
Like, that might just—it probably won't work for me at all. But yeah. But there's—you see that obsession sometimes in reading biographies, and, you know, Lincoln only slept 5 hours a night. That's what I'm going to do. Like, well, yeah. It's probably going to kill you. Like, he understood how he operated. Like, don't try to be someone else. Understand who you are and build your own operating rhythm against that.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's taken me a long time to understand sort of my own operating rhythm, especially, you know, writing a book on creative habits. I realized, I was like, wow, there's a point of the day in which I hit diminishing returns. And for me, it happens right around 10 a.m., which is why I get up so damn early, because I know between 6 and 9 a.m., I'll get, you know, 10x what I would get done between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. And that's one thing I just figured that out about my operating rhythm. Like, my brain is in a very different state of mind early in the morning, in comparison to later in the day.
Yeah, no, I'm the same exact person. I am not a night owl. I mean, I can stay up late, but I'm useless. Like, I can watch some Netflix, but that's about all I'm going to pull up. So writing a book, same thing. Like, I'm a decently disciplined person. So, busy family. My wife works in nonprofit, two kids in school. So I was up at, you know, a little after five every day for, you know, however long, year and a half. I'm really focused on this book. Go downstairs, have a cup of coffee, come back to my desk. I'm writing before six, and I could write intensely for 75 to 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And then that was kind of it. I could keep writing, but the words were just going to turn into drivel. I was no longer writing good sentences, right?
Yeah.
So that was it. That was my intensely focused period of the day for writing. Now, I would think about the book for hours. I'd do research. I'd read other stuff. I'd go back and sort of read a bunch of pages and see if the themes were there, etc. But I didn't try to write intensely. And it's, to your point, I think when I – because people like you, like, well, what's the process of writing a book? I said, well, here's my process. You have to find your own.
Yeah.
And it probably doesn't sound that intense. Like, oh, you wrote for an hour and a half a day. Yep, that's it. But I did that 7 days a week for, you know, a year and a half on end.
Yeah.
And if you just have to figure out what works for you. And I know other people that can write for 5 or 6 hours a day. And that's also fine. So, but it is critical about knowing when are you at your peak to do different sorts of activities.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the decentralization piece, and I want to approach it from the perspective of decision making. Like, how do people become more effective decision makers based on the work that you've done, it, and where can they apply that concept of decentralizing decision making in their lives? I mean, it makes sense to me where you do it in an organization. Like, I've been finally learning to let go of things that I have found myself doing for years, like editing the podcast, and I finally brought on somebody to do it. And I've been kind of amazed at, you know, how much leverage just that one person has given me.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's a critical aspect to just keeping your own sanity. And different personalities have a different level of difficulty with this, depending on how prone you are towards, you know, micromanagement and perfectionism and all these things, which obviously makes that harder. But I do think you can build in drills for yourself to really force this hard question upon you, which is somewhere around, like, what am I trying to accomplish here, and what benefit am I adding to these next several steps? Like, that's a great example with having someone edit your podcast. Like, okay, what's the goal? I want a good show that people can download and listen to, and it's right enough. So probably the first time you listen to an edited one, or second or third, you're like, oh, that, you know, that should have been cut off right here. Da, da, da. But me as a listener, am I going to notice that? No. But so in the 2 hours you would have invested, you'd save, you know, 2 seconds of thought with 5% of your listeners. So it's just not worth it. Right. So you really have to force yourself to say, is this meeting the end state? And that's where it gets interesting, because you say some things, absolutely. Like, if it's edited so that the content comes out wrong, or it's just, you know, you're seeing your listenership go down, then you have to get involved. But if you know what metrics you're trying to meet, then you can really force yourself to decentralize down. And, you know, some people have a natural propensity toward that. I think we have sort of funny conversations inside of our group all the time. The McChrystal group's about 70 folks or so. And, you know, a lot of former folks from the service and special operations, and a lot not. So we're about 50-50 split. And so we're all naturally very comfortable with decentralizing decisions down. And I know, at least I, the folks that work with me, I'm sort of hardwired for that. And it's sort of a new muscle for a lot of people to get used to. But ultimately, there's just no way to move fast enough in today's environment if you're not every day questioning, did I need to make that decision, or could I push that down one level? I mean, you can manage your house like that. You can manage your personal activities inside of a family like that, and just buy not just white space to do more, to be more productive, but time to think, you know, which I think is equally or more important than all the other sort of optimization stuff that people want to get toward these days.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I always hire people to assemble my furniture now because I'm kind of like, when I do this, parts are left over, shit starts falling apart. I'm like, you know what? This is like, you know, something that would take somebody else 50 minutes. It'll take me all day. And that, I think, started to become really apparent to me that I should start letting go of certain decisions.
No, that's a great example. Like I came up in a family that did a lot of like work on houses, like built stuff and redid bathrooms. And just, it's a way that we, I don't know, it's just always part of my family. My wife's family was the same way. And now I'm at a point where I'm like, I could redo that bathroom, but I don't really want to. Like I want to decentralize that, have someone else come up, because it's not something I can do and interact with my kids while I'm doing it. You know, it's my trips back and forth to Home Depot, all that stuff. Yeah. And I'd rather do something as a family while the bathroom's getting redone. So there's countless little decisions like that that people, I think, should really be balancing all the time and how they live their own personal lives.
Yeah. Well, this has been really awesome, like as I expected it would be. I mean, I love the book. It was really, really just eye-opening. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know I've asked you before since we had you here about a year ago. And that is, what do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Yeah, I think last time we talked, I think I probably talked about, you know, people that are in their flow. And my opinion on that has probably just increased over the last few years, which is, that's to say, and you've met these people, but it goes back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier. Most of this is about, you know, an individual journey, like most of this, like figuring out life, et cetera. And it's far too easy and too seductive, I think, and especially in today's world, for people to look outside to what right looks like and try to live into that. And I think that's a roll of the dice, and it's usually going to land on bad numbers, right? And if you're smart and driven and you've got the right pedigree, like you're going to live into whatever life you create inside your head, right? And so I think I've been doing a lot of reading and really interested in this idea of sort of the inner narrative that we're all that's layered into all of us at a very young age. Like, here's the story that Sereni is supposed to live into. And it was created by your uncle and your parents and your first grade teacher and all these people that sort of put this story inside your head. And it's at a very subconscious level. And we were all guilty of it, and it's unavoidable, right? And so you just sort of live into this path, and you find at a certain place, like, this isn't who I want to be. So the most unique people and satisfied people in my life that I know to be around are ones that have come to confront that. And that's a very personal, you know, in your own head sort of discussion, and demonstrate a willingness to break out of it and then recreate the story that they want to live into. And when I've seen people do it, it ends up with, you know, great positive results for them and their family around them. But it also can be hard on relationships, because you're living into becoming something that others, they kind of don't know what that is anymore. You know, you weren't the guy that was supposed to grow up to be a big wave surfer. You're supposed to be an engineer in the valley or something. I don't know. Like, everybody, and it's confusing to others. But ultimately, like, if you're trying to live into that story that others think you should live into, you're setting yourself up for all sorts of frustration down the road. And I'm like you, I'm in my 40s now. So I think that's the first phase of the sort of midlife review, where you start to see peers really question, is this the life I'm supposed to be living? And the negatives of that manifest themselves in all sorts of weird ways. So I think people that can step back from that and really objectively come up with their own plan are putting themselves on a much better heading.
Well, I think it makes a really fitting end to our conversation. Where can people learn more about you, your work, and the book?
Yeah, so One Mission is available on all the big distributors. If people want to pick it up. And then the McChrystal Group, people can just hop online, check out the work we do, and it goes into a lot more depth about what we think is happening in organizations these days.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.